if every nigga who didn't want to be alive died, y'all would be in for a surprise. Thank you for tuning in. You're listening to Abolitionish, a podcast at the end of the world. My name is John Moore, and I am your host, coming to you from Chicago, Illinois. After a too long hiatus, we're back with episode 8, and I'm really excited to welcome to the podcast Princeton Theological Seminary PhD student, Raw.
There's something about Black ontology or non-ontology, like non-beingness, that is just not here.
And Houston-born music and cultural critic, Terhaka Love, to talk about everything.
Anytime that you listen to DMX's music, especially I was listening to Flesh of My Flesh, Blood of My Blood, like crazy over the weekend, and it was damn near line by line. Anytime he was mentioning death, he was mentioning love. As if they were just so connected to one another.
From DMX to Death Doulas, Black Joy, Suffering, The Trial of Derek Chauvin, Yacht Rappers. It's going to be a really special episode, and you can support this work and help our guests get paid by donating to our Patreon, becoming a monthly subscriber at patreon.com/abolitionish. There are a few fun tiers there for you to, you know, live out your hierarchical dreams. You can donate anything from $5 to $100 a month, more if you really got it like that, and get access to first in store merch, unreleased clips from the podcast, conversations with yours truly, although I really, you could really talk to me for free at this point. And a whole lot more. So please support us. And also, support every Black creative in your life. Give them money, pay them. They deserve it. They deserve the world. We deserve it all. So with that said, I am really excited for you all to listen in. And let's do this. Raw is a Black queer New Yorker from the Bronx. She's a graduate of Clark Atlanta and currently a PhD student at Princeton Theological Seminary. She's calling in from South Africa this evening, where she's currently living, and today we're going to talk a bit about Black joy and Black suffering. Raw is the author of Distorted Mirrors, Toward a Clear Gaze on Black Suffering, a really thoughtful article recently published by The Imminent Frame, which is a blog on secularism, religion, and public life, founded by the Social Science Research Council. And Raw is just a sort of newer Twitter homie in my life that I'm grateful for so many reasons. It is so weird to like talk to people who you've never, I mean, it was weird before the pandemic to like talk to people who you'd never met in real life. And so even now it feels, I mean, I guess now maybe it feels more normal. but before we start, you said what?
It's like our world now.
I know. It's so wild how that can, that those borders can be collapsed so quickly. But I appreciate you a lot. I really appreciate, as I was thinking about what to say, I was thinking, the sentence I had in my mind was, I appreciate how you mobilize theory to help Black people describe their own experiences. And the reason I'm being so cautious when I say that is because one way of saying that is to say, like, I appreciate your internet presence, or I appreciate the things you say. But I want to be specific, because that is the part about getting to know you online that I've appreciated, is I think something that I've struggled with as a grad student, just as a Black person, is like what is the role of this thing called theory for the rest of my life? And so, in a very particular way, I've appreciated just how you've modeled like what it means to mobilize. You know, I'm thinking about Patrice Douglas's Black Feminist Theory for the Dead and Dying. You know, and like, just yeah, you've been a real model of what it means to just cut the bullshit and allow theory to do what the very little, but the very important little that it can, if that makes sense. So I appreciate you for that. And I'm so happy that you have graced us with your presence for a little conversation on the podcast.
Thank you, John. John, I love you so much. I don't, it's so weird to tell that to people when it's like, oh, we're like online buddies, but like, I feel like we're real friends.
Yeah, no, deadass. Like, especially because like, I don't know, like, I feel like maybe at this age, I'm 25 going on 26, and I feel like there are people in my life who I'd probably call friends in public, but who, not many anymore, but there are still probably some people who are like, I would refer to them as a friend, but like, I still don't really know them. You know, like people that you had like chemistry class with or some shit. Like, I don't really know you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. I feel like when I was going to say muchie. I feel like when I first started being introduced to your online presence, you were like one of the people that I was learning from, because for a long time, I wasn't like the Twitter girl, I was still on Facebook. And for a long time, I was like just reading the work that you all would do. And I was still deciding if I was going to fuck the AP. So, like, so you were one of the people that I just felt like, I used to watch your like spoken words and stuff that you did. And then as I've like followed you on Twitter, and then just kind of like the Jatellas of the world, all of you all just like really shaped my politic in such a very critical way. So to hear you say that, it's like, oh wow, I was like watching y'all for years before I decided to jump out there on Twitter.
That is funny, in the sense that, yeah, it's like you think that you're the one following, but you're always following someone, or someone's always following you. So, yeah, that's really lovely. So yeah, I'm so excited for this. So I really loved your piece, in The Imminent Frame. And for folks who haven't read it yet, rather than sort of walking them through it, I'm just going to read, one of my favorite parts, and then maybe you can just talk to us a bit about what Black joy means to you, and sort of why you wrote this piece. So Ra writes, as Saidiya Hartman suggests, there seems to be a need to, quote, make narratives of defeat into opportunities for celebration, the desire to look at the ravages and brutality of the last few centuries, but still find a way to feel good about ourselves, end quote. Is the Black captive's joy the horrors of state violence? How are we to pose legitimate critiques of anti-Blackness when Black joy has become its performative stage? And I think the reason why I chose that part of the essay was because I was really struck by this image of Black joy being the performative stage. Your question of like, how do we critique anti-Blackness when joy is like the thing that we like the only authorized place to speak from, I think really resonated with me. And, you know, knowing one's relationship to joy as something you feel, I think is different than like having a relationship to what you're describing, Ra. And so, I would love for you to, talk to us a little bit about, what inspired you to write this piece, and sort of after writing it, sort of, you know, what does Black joy mean to you?
Yeah. So it's so funny. I was, Clubhouse with Christelle yesterday about another piece I wrote, and I was telling her that by the time I write a piece, by the time it's published, you know, you write something and they take like a month or two to publish it, you don't even agree what you wrote anymore, right, with what you wrote anymore. So excuse me. Yeah, so like I wrote the piece specifically because we were, of course, at my height of a really critical election, right? So my piece heavily centers the Democratic Party. And I felt like I was in a very interesting position as an AKA, right? It was like my sorority sisters are like, Kamala Harris is going to be vice president. And then you have this political campaign about all of the AKAs are going to vote for Kamala Harris. And then all of the Divine Nine, which is so, it was some real petty bourgeois bullshit, right? And then it was, I had to make a decision in a way, like, was I going to, like, commit my allegiance to this, like, chosen family that has, like, been such a critical part of my life in a way, right? And that has been a particular side of joy for me, right? Like, HBCU life, sorority life, all of this line, my line sisters, you know, my politics, all of those things. Or was I going to, like, be honest about what we were celebrating in a way? So that was, like, a real personal moment for me. In a real hard conversation to have with a lot of my intimate community. And then the other part of that was, the way that the organizing landscape was set up, there was so much going on around Stacey Abrams and so much going on around voters' rights. And then like people online were just like, these performative anti-imperialists, right? And then people online were also these very real people who felt like, you know, I mean, I'm thinking about people who, you know, have been struggling with like DACA and stuff like that, like who were very serious about, like, in very tangible ways, the way that Donald Trump had completely like disarmed their capacity to feel any type of reprieve, right? I'm not, because of course the are still going to navigate anti-blackness, but like have actually like felt like the government has had their knee on their neck for the last 4 years. And then this conversation that was happening between those of us who were being called privileged for saying, you know, all presidents are war criminals and that's the privileged position right. If you don't get to vote, you know, and then it was just weird because it's like, okay, cool. So I can be privileged because of my Princeton seminary thing, you know, about the president. Cool. It's a posture. It's performative. But then what happens when niggas that are not in my predicament are also saying the same thing, right? So I'm like, these people are actually saying this too, and they're not at Princeton. So what do we do about that conversation? So it was just a lot going on for no reason. We were in the height of a pandemic. So I was just like, it was a lot going on, and I felt like, Ahmaud Green Hayes had asked me to do the piece, and I was just like, sure, you know, I didn't have anything else to do, so I was like, sure, I'll be a part of the forum, and it actually came out to be a really great forum. So all of that to say, the question of joy rose for me because the forum was so heavily linked to, like, religion, Black death, Black dying, Black living in COVID, right? But it was a religious studies forum, and what I found was, like, I really don't have shit to say about Black religious experiences. I don't even know how I ended up in this. It's disappointing. I'm like, I was in undergrad, and I was a criminal justice major when I went in, and then I, like, took a African-American religious experiences class, fell in love with the way that people talked about Black life, and just took all of the religion classes, and if I wanted to graduate on time, I had to become a religion major. So that's how I got in religious studies. It's not because I actually care, right? And so I just needed to graduate. And so then I ended up getting a master's in religion, all these good things, and now I'm stuck. So all of that to say, I grew up in the Black church too, in a very peculiar way. Like, my grandmother was an evangelist in the Church of God in Christ. My mother was very much so committed to the church because her mother was an evangelist. My father is also a pastor. So it was all of those things happening. And I remember this song that they used to sing, it was like this, or the saying rather, but it was also part of hymnals and stuff, but it's this joy that I have, the world didn't give it and the world can't take it away. And that to me was like such a critical move, especially as someone who thinks with AP, and understands that the position of the Black is that there are no Blacks in the world, but there's no world without the Blacks, right? Like, this source of, like, living or beingness or non-beingness for us as people, this way in which we, like, know that, like, we vote against our own interests right? Or we're committed in a way to our own demise, and yet these become celebrations, right? That Sadia Hartman quote, like these become celebrations of what is possible when we struggle, particularly with the narrative of Biden, when Black women struggle. And yeah, so that became the motivating force for me to be like, I need to say something about Black joy in a way that doesn't shame Black people for the ways that they make meaning out of the world, because that then becomes the function of that religious studies piece, right? Like, there's a difference between religion and theology. Theology is, you know, what do people say about God, or God's understanding, or God's activity in the world, and how we think provide a hermeneutics of that. And the religious studies is, how do people find meaning, the ways that people make meaning out of the world. So it's more of a philosophical tent, and I'm being trained as an ethicist, of course. So I had to figure out that meaning part of this suffering. And I hate that. I hate that, right?
Yeah.
Because I don't want the conclusion to be that there's anything meaningful about this,
right?
Or there's anything redemptive, right, about this, or that there's anything salvageable, right? I don't want to have to align myself with this kind of Christological notion of, or teleological reality of an alternative that we get free or we get liberated and everything's going to be all right, right? Like, that's another hymnal. They say, like, I got this feeling that everything's going to be all right. And it's just like, I don't have that feeling. We're fucked, right? This is my disposition in writing this. Like, but then amidst all of that, I have to grapple with the fact that niggas are outside dancing in the middle of the street. And I mean, we're not just talking about cis people. We're talking about queer and trans people too, right? Like, dancing in the middle of the street,
yeah,
because Trump is out of office.
Right.
Right. I mean, right. People are like, if they're, I mean, Georgia flips. Georgia becomes a swing state. And it becomes a celebration about the actual organizing capacity of poor Black women.
Yeah.
Like, that becomes something that it's almost like fucking cognitive dissonance. Can I curse on your panel? I don't know. Like,
yes, always.
It becomes this kind of like dissonance for me. And I don't know if you read it, you could see that I'm struggling through it. Like, I don't land at a particular answer, which is why the conclusion of the piece, I want to undo so bad, because I feel like I offer a prescription that I didn't want to go to, but I felt like I have a problem with just, like, you know, just landing in the gore of it all. So I tried to offer something that could posture toward a political stance that I would take. But all that to say that, so the heart of the joy piece for me was in the Iyanla Van Zandt moment, right? And I hate that because Iyanla's so problematic. But Iyanla has this moment where with Shay Johnson and her mother, and she's like, look in the mirror and tell me what you see. And the mirror is beaten up. It's beaten up. It's trash. It's a distorted mirror. It's literally, like, purposely. Iyanla just wants them to look at the mirror and say, the mirror's broke. I can't see anything, right? And these women say, we see strong, beautiful Black women. I mean, they're not even looking at the mirror anymore. They're just like, okay, cool. So everything's broken. So we're just going to completely, like, jump straight to eschatology, right? We're just going to jump to an alternative. We're going to escape this reality and name a new reality for ourselves. We're not even here anymore. Like, we're not playing your game, Iyanla. We're not doing this. And Iyanla's like, how did you land there? Where did you go? Where right. did you go? Mm. Like, where did you just go to land at what you just told me you were? Why are you on my show if you're a strong, beautiful Black woman? Why did you come here? Right? That was just, and I was like, wow, like that. But their source of being, their source of joy, right? What gave them the strength to even have the humility to be transparent about the volatile relationship that her and her daughter was, Shay and her mother was going through, was the fact that they still found something that they could reclaim about themselves amidst the chaos, amidst the violence, right? And so the violence was a sense of joy for them, right? I mean, Shay's entire career is built upon the violence. And so, I don't have an answer for you, but when I think about that and I think about the spiritual, right, John, I'm just like, there's something about Black ontology or non-ontology, like non-beingness, that is just not here. And I think about The Hold of the Ship so much, and I think with Christina Sharpe's work, but I think about The Hold of the Ship and, you know, that Fred Moten quote about how, like, they were alive through it all, right? And I'm trying to figure out where the fuck did everybody go, right? Because some of us are here and we're like, oh, shit.
Yeah. I love that.
Like, some of us are here and like, oh, shit is fucked. The world's on fire. These people are killing. Like Biden's administration has deported more people, more Haitians than the Trump administration. And there has not been a national outcry about this. I mean, like, we know these things. We know that these reports are happening. But there is still a reprieve because we don't have the hysteria of, like, the fascism that Trump was, like, spewing, right? And so I'm just like, there's a way in which Black people, where they find their joy is not here, but they actually go somewhere, which tells me that there's a whole lot of Black people that we're interacting with, but they're not here. I mean, literally, they're not here. They're not present. And I don't know, I mean, that might be a psychoanalytic statement. I might not have done all the reading, right? But I'm just saying, like, with that being said, it's like, we have to follow that flight to figure out where the hell is everyone else at so that we can locate the joy that keeps people desiring their own suffering. I hope I answered your question.
Yeah, no, you absolutely did. And yeah, that's so interesting. So I'm going to read to you and to the listeners something that you know I'm always talking about and something that I know you like. It's Anthony Paul Farley's Perfecting Yes. Slavery. And there's the thing I love about, well, the stylistic thing that I'm so fascinated with by Farley is the repetition in the text. And so, because I think it really embodies that kind of the thing you're talking about. So there's a moment on page 237 of this article where Farley writes, we are called to be, and then we become something. We become that which we make of ourselves. We follow the call. We pursue a calling. Freedom is the only calling. It alone contains all possible directions, all of the choices that may later blossom into the fullness of our lives. We can only be free. Slavery is death. How do slaves die? Slaves are not born, they are made. The slave must be trained to be that which the living cannot be. The only thing that the living are not free to be is dead. And like, just like this line of like, well, the whole thing, but when he's like, we can only be free, slavery is death. Like, nigga, you just told me that we can only be free. And I just love that he, it's not written the other way around. And so, you know, this idea that, you know, where we find ourselves has as much to do with our desire to be here or not be here as it does anything else. I think that is really, well, obviously it's antagonistic to our fields of thought. It's antagonistic to so much sort of, I don't know, so much rhetoric about Black life. But it's also like a really, you know, like niggas are always talking about Afro-pessimists being like actually pessimistic. And I'm like, this is actually so optimistic. Like, he literally just said, like, we can only be free. And yet here we are as slaves. So what's the tea, right? Like, so what's the tea? And I don't know what fucking part, where it is in this essay or if it's in another one, but the line that your ending reminded me of. So I'm going to read your ending. So if folks aren't looking at it. So Ra ends, her essay by asking, can the Black captive find joy through this gaze of Black suffering and escape, especially since this joy that we have, the world didn't give it, and the world can't take it away? And it reminds me of this question that Farley asks in something. I don't know if it's this essay in that new book or whatever, but he says something like, it's something about answering the call. And he says, anything is possible. And your ending strikes me as that kind of plenitude. It's not a optimism as much as it is just like a reckoning with like the sheer potential of not being here, or the sheer potential of divesting, the sheer potential of not desiring to be here. What that makes room for.
Or not being alive to being here, mm-hmm, right?
Mm-hmm,
like,
yeah.
It's kind of what, I don't know, I think Woody Smith says this in the 2020 book, but he said something like, to never be alive again to, never be alive again to, like, the euphoria of, like, of, in a way, of Black Jacket. I don't remember exactly how he framed it, but I can't, it's really lost in my memory right now. But he was saying, again, to never be alive again to the joy of, like, nothing in it, like a Black president, or what can be possible, or like, you know, this progress, to never feel alive again to that, right? And so that's kind of where I share that sentiment of that hymnal at the end, right? Like, this joy that I have, the world didn't give, and the world can't take it away, because this is the heart of my project. The heart of my project is to see death as plenitude, and that is not synonymous to redemption or resurrection, as, like, you know, the Christians would put it. It's to say that, like, there is a source of thriving in dying. And where I'm going with that, particularly, you know, it's not fully thought out. I have to take my comp shop. Where I'm going with that is that I think a lot about the tools, like, okay, for example, I think I spoke about this before, but Big Meat, I was watching this documentary, and I remember calling my best friend, and I was like, have you ever seen a limo get pulled over by the police, or a hearse, like, you know, the funeral home hearse that they carry the bodies in the casket in? Mm-hmm. Have you ever seen that get pulled over by the police? And she was like, no. I was like, me either. I've never seen a limo get pulled over by the police. So I was watching this documentary, and that's how they transported drugs. These cars are symbolic for what you carry black people's bodies in, right? You carry these, and that's when the police leave you alone, because you're dead. They're not going to pull over a funeral home car, you know, because you're already dead. I mean, like,
yeah.
this is the joy of the state, mourn your loved ones. And so what they did was they took the tools of the dying, and they use it as a source of thriving to travel their drugs across state lines through these cars, mm-hmm. so that nobody would bother them, because they thought that they were already dead. They didn't think there was drugs in there. They thought it was a body, and that's good to them, right? Like, that's what's supposed to be in that car, a black person's body. And so what the underground economies don't do is try to redeem these things, right? They don't try to, like, make state violence a celebration, or they don't try to make the police reform the police or anything like that. They say, okay, these niggas are out to kill us, so let's use how they view us as a source of thriving, right? Like, let's take the things that they will put our bodies in and put our drugs in there, so that when we're driving, instead of driving in these, like, Cadillacs or whatever, they're not going to pull over because the expectation is for our bodies to be in there. They're going to leave us alone when we're dead. This is the point, right? And I'm so fascinated with that because as a Black religious scholar, and as one who is forced to make meaning out of suffering and unwilling to do that, like, I'm fundamentally unwilling to do that, I have to see Black religion as a religion of the death doula, right? And the death doula is not just the person who holds your hand and cares for you and walks you through the dying process. It's the one that helps you accept the fact that you are dying. This is the only way out. There's no other alternative. You only call me when you've accepted the fact that death is the solution at this point. Yeah,
there's no healing here.
Yeah, there's no healing, right? So, like, how best do you want to make this transition, right? Like, how do you want to thrive through this transition of dying? Because you're going to die. That's it. You called me because you understand that this is the conclusion. And that's how I understand how these underground worlds maneuver. This is how I understand Black religion, right? Like, this is how I understand slave religion. That, and by Black religion, I'm very intentional. I'm not talking about the Black church, right? But I understand fundamentally the church to be a humanist project. By Black religion, I'm talking about that place that I'm talking about in this article, where Black people go, right, to these spaces where they are in a way marooned, right? They can't be located. They can't be found. There's no tracking them because they're not here. Their bodies are present, though, right? So it's like you can. It's like that slave saying, "You can get my body, but you can't kill my soul," right? I mean, we could talk about all the ways that the Black soul, the ontology of the slave, is already violated and ruptured and fractured. Is, you know, anti-Blackness is a metaphysical and ontological violence. We can do that work, and the work that we can also do is to talk about if the primary disposition of the Black is to die or to be dead, right? Then that is what we know. That is not the base of fear. That's the isness of our being. And I don't have all of the ways of like constructing that. I'm still working through it. But that as an alternative to me is not it's not doom. Right? Like, it's not doom. Because it's the courage that drug dealers get when they decide we're gonna sell drugs, and we know that we're gonna be criminalized, and we know we're gonna be under surveillance, we know we're gonna have to get trap phones, we're gonna have to do all of this. But if we end up in jail for this, right, like, we're gonna create a pipeline from the streets to the prison. So that way, for the young cats who, if they do end up in here, they'll have protection. And I just think that it's in death that Black people curate a bunch of safety nets to where, and maybe this is the heart of themes of subjection, right? Where captivity or death or slavery or whatever you want to call it is durable. And so much of Blackness is building the capacity to suffer. That's what all these, to me, the Black church and all of these humanist projects is like, how do we continuously build the capacity to suffer, right? And I'm so interested in the people who are not just interested in endurance, but the people who are actually bold enough to die.
Yeah.
And that is not this martyrdom complex, right? Mm-hmm. Or this like revolutionary suicide. It's just people who are death doulas, who are like, y'all, like, you called me because this is the only conclusion. I can't undo the logics of anti-Blackness. I can't act like the state is not trying to kill me every day. I can't act like I'm not poor. So what are all of the ways in which the state presupposes my death? I understand that to be the grammar of suffering, right? Like, all of the ways that we can predict that Black people die and the expectations for how we see, or the spaces where we assume Black bodies to operate or Black people's bodies to maneuver, right? And those spaces are the graveyards, the prisons, the funeral home hearths. Like, these are the spaces that we leave Black people's bodies alone. We leave Black people alone, and we don't surveil and interrogate their bodies when they are in spaces of graveyards.
Yeah.
And yeah. That's when Black people are like, okay, cool. So we got them off our backs. We can go somewhere now.
Yes, you say, we organize playgrounds to stabilize our communities, yet we find ourselves destabilized through the way state violence commodifies Black joy.
Right. And I think before that, I say something about, I list all of the ways that we die, or all of the ways that we organize our own death, right? Or organize toward our own death. And I talk about protests and stuff, and I say that that's Toni Morrison's, like, playing in the dark.
Yeah.
Like, so death to us is like playground. Graveyards are our playground. I mean, Tamir Rice dies in a park.
Yeah, right.
Right, so like when we talk about fun, when we're talking about, this is the heart of the piece. When we're in the streets celebrating and having parades because there's a president of the United States who is now a black woman, that is a celebration of our own death. It's a funeral. So the particular black funerals are always celebrations. Right? And that's just what yeah. I'm trying to say is that there's the critiques that we have about how we do life is because we have turned funeral, like we have turned life into one big funeral. Like black people understand that, oh, all this shit is deadly. So it's a homegoing service. Everything that we do, we're going to put a black woman in office, it's going to come at our expense. If we're going to, you know, have babies, they're going to die in parks. Yep. If we're going to go to these academies,
yep.
they're going to commodify revolutionaries, right? And so we're going to have a funeral service for all this shit. We're going to celebrate all this shit because there's only one way out for us, and that's death. And I'm just really interested in the death doula, like how black people have made life one big funeral home. In every capacity. Mm. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no.
And maybe that's a reach. Maybe no. I'm doing a lot. Maybe I'm reaching.
I like that. Have you ever watched 6 Feet Under?
No.
So it's a drama from the early 2000s. It's about this white family. I forget what state. I think they're in California. But they own a funeral home. And the whole show, all the seasons are just... They're about the people that they bury and the lives they lived, but they're also about them and their own relationship to death. I think you would love it. It's a white show, obviously, but it's actually really addicting and amazing. And the acting is really beautiful. And my friend Gilberto got me into it, and it's really a great show. But the reason I just brought it up because I want you to watch it, but, also because I don't think it's a stretch. You mentioned,
but the language of the funeral home is really important to me. I'm sorry.
Keep going.
It's different than us saying that like black girl magic. I'm not interested in us misdiagnosing this, right? So I'm fine if we're just like, okay, shit, we gonna have a death party, but I want us to know that this is a death party. Like, that's the thing for me. Like, this is a death party. Like, this is, all right, so we all call the death doula. Like, when we take our asses to the polls, that's us phoning the death doula. Like, hey, we need you to intervene. We're ready to die.
Yeah.
And so we do this at our own expense. I'm interested in us categorizing our joy in that way.
Mm.
Right? And that gets us at a more honest and honest and like a form of integrity that does black suffering a kind of due diligence that doesn't obscure the fact that this is suffering. So what I'm not saying is like, hey, we're all dying, but it is kind of like what we do. Like all my friends are dead. Push me to the edge. Like all my friends are dead. Like this is what we do is like, it's a form of fearlessness. And I'm saying if we're going to say that we're going to be fearless because death is our ontological disposition, then let's do that. But I'm not interested in not seeing these practices as not non-death dealing. And I think so much of the problem is that we refuse to see it as death dealing. And that means that we then foreclose the possibility of other people to consent to the fact that they want to die. So we determine everybody else's death. And I'm saying when you call the death doula, it's because you've made your peace with the fact that this is the only way out. And I mean, I agree with that conclusion. You know what I mean? I think you should make your peace with that. But at the same time, I think that you should allow, there should be a process by which we don't lie to children. And I mean, we can have the conversation about black children don't get to be black children, but I'm not interested in telling little girls that if you want to be president of the United States of America, you're not killing people. Right. I want little girls to be like, I want to kill people.
Right.
And this is why I want to be president. I don't want them to say I want to change the world. Because that's just dishonest.
As you likely know by now, DMX is no longer with us. After an iconic career, the rapper, actor, writer, who left an indelible mark on the 90s, all the way from It's Dark and Hell Is Hot to Belly, passed earlier this month after a heart attack at the age of 50. And to help us pause and reflect on his impact and the legacy he leaves us, I am humbled and pleased to welcome a good friend. Tarhaka Love is a culture writer and cultural worker from Houston. His work on music, pop culture, and politics has been published in Rolling Stone, the Los Angeles Times, Entertainment Weekly, and more. And recently, his thoughtful reading of DMX's career and life landed in the New York Times. In What DMX's Poetry of Death Did for Hip Hop, Love writes, DMX lived to tell his own story. He knew there were so many ways to die. In control, suddenly, slowly. But ultimately, DMX earned what he had always sought, a poet's death. Tarhaka, welcome to the podcast, my nigga.
Yo, John, thanks for having me, man.
Yeah, so, all right, so, you know, Avi, I loved the piece, and I'm excited to talk about X and also your work, and sort of what the relationship between those are. So you talk a bit in, you know, about how X was different from the yacht faring niggas of the day, namely Jay and Diddy. And on Twitter, you called DMX rap's most loving reaper. What's the things called, like, you would get in, like, high school yearbooks? What's that shit called?
Oh, like a superlative?
Yeah, it's like the ultimate nigga superlative. It's like most loving reaper, you know, like, and I just love it because it seems so important that, like, for someone who, as you, you know, precisely right, like, for someone who death was with the entirety of his career, it seems important, right, to, like, not toss that to the wayside in how we remember him. And I would love for you to talk a bit about what DMX means to you, especially, right, like, as a Black person who is writing about music and culture.
Yeah. First of all, I mean, one of the things that immediately just jumps out about DMX is his remarkable honesty, right? That's the biggest thing. He's just super sincere and very genuine about his struggle. Through his teenage years, you know, going through the, basically a not even like a school to prison pipeline, just going to juicy, you know, just like going to a boys' school from the ages of like 8 to 14, I want to say, and just not having a strong relationship with his parents or his mother, who was abusive. And yeah, he was just very candid about that sort of stuff, and he used that honesty to speak to folks who were downtrodden. He rapped about homelessness. You know, he rapped about being in poverty. He rapped about his addiction. And those things, while I think in today's time, I mean, there are many people who do come from rap circles who started out in that, in those sort of environments, but it and now it sort of feels more aesthetic, right? It's meant as a way to establish a kind of authenticity. When DMX was living this shit day in and day out, and you could feel it in his rap. So the honesty was one thing. And then when you think about just the delivery, like, that shit will smack you in your face. You listen to Rough Riders after the Anthem, you're getting smacked in the face. You know what I'm saying? Like, if you listen to Flesh of My Flesh and Blood of My Blood, like, it's just real fucking rap. And something that, you know, really sort of set him apart from his colleagues at the time, who were trying to make this switch from rapping about the street. And I think, you know, the switch was what it did feel sort of authentic, but it also felt like opportunistic. And I say authentic in the sense of, I think that hip hop was really mourning Pac and Biggie. They were like, it's obvious, but it's a very opportunistic way of shifting that narrative to make hip hop not just sort of like a rags to riches story, but just more appealing to a softer white audience. And that's not to say that DMX didn't have a white audience. I think there's clips of, I can't remember what festival it is that goes around damn near every year, of him performing some of his hottest records, and there's like a sea of white people. So we know that he had a white audience, but he was talking to niggas, man. He was talking about niggadom, and he was talking specifically to niggas. And it wasn't about about being flashy. It wasn't about rapping about like fucking Basquiat and going to the MoMA and or fucking Chris Paul or like rapping about like platinum jewelry or anything like that. Like, he was talking about real shit, and he just kept that going his entire career. It just never really switched up. And so for me, his impact was I felt like when I was younger, I felt like I had this like crazy temper that sort of like set me apart from my family in certain ways. And he could rap to that. Like, he could rap to that anger, to that rage, not to a sense of like making me want to rage out necessarily, but just to relate to someone else who's going through something. And, you know, I didn't grow up poor. I didn't grow up, you know, going through the sort of systems and institutions that he did. But I could relate to the anger. I could relate to the disillusionment with, like, the idea that somebody's not telling me the truth about something, and it pisses me the fuck off. And the truth back then was that niggas are still dying either slow death, like I said, sudden death. They're dying social death, and we're not rapping about it no more. And something's up with that. And so he was just that person who was like, you know, I'm gonna stick to what I know, and I'm not gonna try and come up out of myself just because I have a couple platinum records. Like, he just never switched up, and I really appreciated that. And you know, and to me, he was this sort of carryover from the Pac era. I honestly believe that he is the embodiment of a post-Pac. He was very sincere, very sort of emotional. And he also was someone who was very connected to sort of marginalized, impoverished communities. And he had that mythological sort of respect. So those are the sort of things that I was trying to get at with the piece. And he just had a wide sort of, a really wide and really deep impact on people. I think we saw that when it was announced that he had, you know, fallen into a coma.
You said something, you said he didn't come out of himself. And when you said it, it reminded me of, I don't know the man's name, but it's a black dude. And I didn't watch any of the Derek Chauvin trial. But what I did see on Instagram was a clip of this black dude who's on the witness stand. And the prosecutor is trying to rile him up and he's just trying to rile him up. And the black guy is like, you can't paint me. He's basically like, you can't paint me as angry. Like, I watched someone be killed and I didn't come out of myself. And so I just think that, like, when you don't come out of yourself, when you don't adapt to, I don't know, like, the expectations of the industry, the expectations of capital, the expectations of an officer or a prosecutor.
That is such a tough fucking thing to say. Like, I saw this man die and I didn't come out of myself. What does that mean? Like,
right.
Fuck. Like we've had to watch our people die and somehow sort of maintain our sense of presence and our sense of self and the fact that we can. It's not something that I'm like necessarily proud of. You know what I'm saying? Like, for him, in that sense, like, I imagine just the shock of that is damn near paralyzing. And for DMX, too, I wouldn't say it's necessarily all a good thing, because in the midst of, you know, the celebrations of his career, were people who were like, hey, like, this dude was mad homophobic and dropped homophobic lines in songs on classic records, you know what I'm saying? So, and you know, he had his verses with Snoop just recently, and he didn't, you know, he decided to still drop that song and still rap that song, and that's what it was. And, you know, people do bring up his sort of history of substance abuse, but also, I guess, like, physical abuse. But it does, when people do bring that up, I think it's very valid, and I wouldn't want anyone to forgive DMX. I think forgiveness is a very personal thing. But what I will say is that if we are looking through a lens of abolition, if we're looking through a lens of anti-capital, and if we're looking through a lens of real sort of empathy and accountability, we have to take into account his traumas. We have to take into account, you know, his traumas as a child, and the fact that he was literally betrayed by people that he loved. Not just his mentor, which, you know, I think that story went around quite a bit. His mentor sort of lacing his first sort of, or lacing a blunt with crack cocaine, which started off his sort of trajectory with addiction, his lifelong fight with addiction. That's something that we have to consider. I just want to put everything out there in the sense of, like, yeah, he needs to be held to account. And part of his persona to me was the realization that he didn't like that person. He didn't like the person that he became while he was abusing drugs. But, you know, at the same time, he did harm other people. And so it's like, it's a very messy thing, and it's something that we have to parse out as a social order. And okay, I understand that harm, and I think that those people that he did harm have no obligation to forgive him at all, or to look at him in any sort of positive light. But for me, as someone who's actively trying to resist the bullshit, is what I'll call it, just the bullshit. I want to take into account the entirety of this man's life and understand that he was betrayed and abused for a long time, for a very, very long time. And yeah, and that doesn't even speak to the abuse that he experienced while in prison. So yeah, it's a lot to sort of deal with. But as a person who, again, never came out of himself, it's a bittersweet thing, because perhaps if he did, he could have evolved in that way. And I think, you know, the work that he did outside of just music, as it relates to communities, as it relates to, as I sort of mentioned in the piece, like poor folks who lived, or homeless folks who lived in Philadelphia, or the church in Yonkers that was about to, that actually got foreclosed, and he bought and he gave it back to the pastor. Like, these are real people, and who knows among them how many of them are queer and how many of them are, you know, like, on the spectrum, or, you know, I just think that it's a lot messier than even I sort of set out in the article itself. So yeah, it's a lot. I said a lot there, but yeah, it's a lot. It's a lot to sort of take in with his life and his persona.
I'm happy we actually ended up. So I'm going to say two things, and then I'm going to bring us back to God's plan. And let's see if that actually works. So the two things I wanted to say about things that you said, One was this idea of coming out of yourself and about, you know, the ambivalence around that. And there's this legal theorist named Anthony Farley, and I'm crazy about him. I think he's so smart, and he has this article called Perfecting Slavery. And basically, he talks about how one way to think about Black agency is to think of it as perfecting slavery, right? So you either come out of yourself or you don't, and you stay a slave, right? Like, you either answer the call of the wild, the call of let's fry these niggas up and have brunch, or you answer the call of the state, which is, you know, go home, it's curfew, be peaceful, right? And how that's really all you have. Like, I'm often turned off by people who I feel like are living in this in-between where they are cosplaying answering the call of the wild while also, you know, working for the police or something like that, right? It's like, I mean, same with art, like Spike Lee, right? I'm like, I fucking hate Spike Lee because Spike Lee cosplays as a nigga who is answering the call of the wild. Meanwhile, he's doing like PR spots for NYPD, right? So it's like,
right.
So I would actually rather you just be like, I don't know, JoJo Siwa, Peppa the Pig. Like, you can go to the complete other end of this binary and I will actually fuck with you more, you know?
At least you're being real.
At least you're being real. Like, at least you're like, I have nothing here for, like, I have nothing for you. Like, I am completely disinvested in your well-being. I don't know who you are. At least I know. DMX is seen as someone, I mean, you know, in the obituaries that were written after his death, I think that's something that mainstream media emphasized a lot, was the rawness, the anger, and yet had he not done what he did, had he not continued writing and performing the way he did, you know, and died, I'd be calling him a sellout, a pussy, you know, like,
right.
a fucking billionaire, you know, like, I mean, the shit that people are going to say when Jay-Z dies, right? Like,
yeah, that's, you know, going to be, oof.
Right. It's like, you know, I mean, maybe really, really old heads will be like, no, but for niggas who grew up in the B era, it's like, I mean, what can you say? So that was on my mind. But then also the role of addiction in DMX's life and his catalog. Mm-hmm. And I think it's so interesting, right? Because as I was preparing for this, I was thinking, like, where do I find, like, what is the musical? I mean, rap in particular, like, what are we saying about addiction nowadays? Like, not just in like cultural discourse and politics, whatever, but like, what is our music saying about it? And I was just thinking of how, didn't like The Weeknd like win like a Kids' Choice Award or something for like, the, you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. It's like a song about cocaine.
Yeah. So, it's like, I can't feel my face when I'm with you. There you go. Can't feel my face.
Yo.
So,
wild shit we living through right now.
Yeah. So I'm like, okay, so Can't Feel My Face is getting like children's pop music awards. However,
we are so fucked,
right? Because maybe, you know, maybe I'd be excited about that if that meant that like niggas who are addicted to shit could actually get help. Right. But, and you know, had you, I don't know, like been there in the 90s and had someone tell you that in 2021, that's what was going to be going on, maybe an optimist would say, oh shit, like that must be the compliment, is that this is a culture that has decriminalized and destigmatized drug use so much that they're able to celebrate it in this way that is not where drug use is not just drug abuse.
Right.
And so, right. So I'm just, yeah, I'm just thinking about addiction, especially just cause like in a, I'm sorry, my cat is trying to get, you don't ever get on my desk. She never gets on my desk. And now that I'm doing this, she wants to get and put her ass right on the microphone. What is wrong with you? Fucking. Oh,
yo, you might have a druggy cat, yo. She
yo,
heard, she
I know.
Heard
it. She said, where's the fucking blow, man? Fucking weirdo, yo. But,
but yeah, you're right. I mean, we don't have a healthy relationship with these substances at all. And it's not like that shit is like so far out of our grasp that it's like impossible to have an adult, like healthy relationship with substances. But when you start to get into addiction, and this is something that I think Bell Hooks talks about in All About Love, which is like randomly, she like threw this in about addiction. Addiction is a form of greed. You know what I'm saying? It's tied back into that simply, like that simple capitalistic principle of greed. And this idea that you just must have it. You must have it. Everything else goes outside the window. It is like, I won't call it the extreme form of greed because we can see with our own eyes what the extreme form of greed actually is. And it's, we see it every single day. But I will say that it is a type of, it is a greedy disease, you know? And if we live in a culture that cared about the earth, first of all, and, understood it, we might be in a better place in terms of not just talking about drugs, but also like helping folks who are dealing with the very real possibility that you are hooked on this thing, right? Because honestly, a lot of times when you're hooked on a drug, it has very little to do with the drug. It has everything to do with your circumstance. And so, yeah, I just think that we don't really have a healthy relationship with it. I know that, and I feel it all the time when I talk about my own sort of dalliance, I'll say, with drugs. Sometimes I'll be like nervous about telling people that shit because, you know, there's a lot of their stigma tied to it. But at the same time, it's like there shouldn't be because we're all out here just trying to fucking live. Like, I can't look down on DMX's addiction if I'm literally high all day, every day. You know what I'm saying? Like, if I'm smoking weed, like I'm sorry, like, I just can't do that. People would consider it a more extreme drug than something like marijuana or even just powder cocaine, that being crack cocaine. Like they might consider it something different, but it comes from the same place. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's the same impulse, I think. But we have ideas tied to these things, and those ideas are the ones that lead to spirals. Those ideas are the ones that lead to overdoses, I think. That's just how I sort of see it. Hope I'm not offending anybody with that, but yeah, like I just don't think that we put ourselves in the shoes of other people enough. Like, I think about coffee drinkers. Coffee is like the most fucking prevalent drug. Like, it feels like the most prevalent drug in the world, or at least in Western culture, to me. Yeah. And people are on it all day. We have different variations of it, you know? We have whole coffee shops. We have business, like, Starbucks is a drug pusher. Like, we not, you know what I'm saying? Like, those are drugs, and we don't have a healthy relationship with caffeine either. So it's all of that to me. It's all of that to me. If we can't put those in on the same spectrum, then that sort of leads to that terrible relationship that we have with substances and the people that use them, to be honest. Especially the ones that we consider, oh, this is the worst thing that you can put. Like, okay, the reason why you're saying that is because niggas use it. That's it. Like, that's it. It's tied to niggas. And right. So now it's right. The worst thing in the fucking world. As right. If niggas don't drink coffee.
Right. Day in and day out. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It makes me think of I haven't read it, but there's this book by this Columbia professor called, his name is Carl Hart, and the book is called Drug Use for Grownups. And he and he talks pretty candidly, like you were talking about using heroin regularly. And there's so much interesting discourse among academics, but also just among Twitter niggas about class and privilege and all this shit. And I felt like a lot of the discourse was just smokescreen for not fucking with the idea of niggas using drugs. Like one of the things that if I had like a million years to study shit, one of the things I'd really love to write a book on is like black drugs experiences. And not just like psychedelics and hallucinogens and shit, but like addictive substances like crack. You know, we talk about internalized anti-blackness. We talk about all this shit. And yeah, like you point out, like niggas were making fun of DMX until he died.
Yep.
You know, like DMX was a crackhead punchline until he died. And so, and a lot of those niggas who were, and you know, and to be quite honest, like a lot of those niggas who were outside the hospital, like when his body was being taken, themselves probably do not have supportive relationships with people who are addicted to drugs or abuse them or whatnot, right? And also a lot of those niggas are high all the time, like you said. And it's interesting, right? Because like, I mean, I think part of it is, I'll just speak from personal experience. So like, I take Adderall, which is truly, you talk about coffee, like this shit should be illegal. Like I consume it, okay, legally, okay. I feel like all my good friends smoke weed regularly. I have no tolerance for weed. It makes me hallucinate. I can't even do like, I bought a few weeks ago, I bought like an 8-to-1 CBD THC strain. Still high as hell. Like truly ridiculous. So there's that. But I also know addiction firsthand. Like I have crack addiction in my family. And so I grew up with it around me. I grew up with sort of the familial, the emotional, the spiritual consequences of addiction, not just to the person who's addicted, but to those around them. It's jarring to think that. So, for example, like I grew up being like, I'm never going to do drugs.
Yep.
You know, like on my Mr. Mackey shit, like drugs are bad. I'm okay.
I'm okay.
And here I am, right, taking my little 10 milligrams of Adderall every day to function. And I'm not saying that to condemn myself or to praise myself. I'm just making an observation.
What I'm talking about might save your life someday, okay?
Okay, Mr. Mackey, okay?
Okay.
Okay?
Okay.
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 As a black person, about my relationship to substances, as someone who is trying to make it every day, but also as someone who's trying to feel every day, right? Even if I don't feel great, I still want to feel. And like, you know, like we all have the shit that we wouldn't do. And like, for me, it's like, I wouldn't do shit that prevents me from feeling, even if those feelings are bad.
I think some people did mention this with DMX in his passing, is that he was a child of the Reagan era, you know? That was the period, and he was a child of the Reagan era in Yonkers at the time when that shit was at its height. And so the idea that he was just going to put that shit away once he got famous, or once once his records went platinum, or once he had the hottest thing, like, it just don't work like that. It just don't. And I saw people really being callous about his death, saying that, oh, you know, if he was so concerned with death, he probably should have stopped doing drugs. I'm just like, yo, are you okay? So stop drinking coffee right now.
Right, like, right, bitch.
Stop.
See if you can get it through day. See if you can get your fucking email sent. Right.
right. This is what he felt like he had to do to get through, at least at when he was at the height of his youth. And that doesn't mean that he... Again, it doesn't mean that he liked the person that he was when he was fiending or when he was high. But it does mean that there was something there was something missing that like we have to attend to if we want to avoid more deaths like this. You know what I'm saying? More tragedy like this. DMX was 50, bro. DMX was 50.
Yeah, yo.
That's it.
He's younger than my dad, younger than my mom.
Yeah. Same. Yeah. Yeah. He was 50, bro. So there's clearly something missing there. And I think it does sort of tie back to this other stuff that we're talking about in terms of like being accountable and stuff like that. Okay. Accountability means you have to take that shit into account. You know what I mean? What was he missing?
Yo, and what's so scary to me about that, like about how what is missing never makes it into the conversation for celebrities, but also just everyday niggas. Like when someone like takes their own life, right? Suddenly the conversation is about like, you know, it's assumed that whatever was missing couldn't be found. And maybe assuming something's missing is a problem in the first place, maybe. But
yeah,
I guess what I'm saying is that like the assumption is that something that could have kept someone alive and experiencing simply was not possible for them. Right. And I feel like in that way it normalizes it, right? Where it's like, oh, it's a tragedy, but like, what the fuck else can you do? Or like the person you were talking about, it's like, oh yeah, well, like, you know, if he really wanted to be alive. And it's like, intent, like desire is not what. If every nigga who didn't want to be alive died, y'all would be in for a surprise. You know, like,
absolutely.
It's not always desire that keeps niggas here as much as it is like resources or support or happenstance or responsibility or whatever, right?
Come on.
What do you think are some things that younger artists and younger generations of Black listeners might learn from listening to DMX's catalog? Post-DMX, you know, you talked about DMX being the post-Pac, and, you know, what if someone was a post-DMX artist, what would that look like to you?
It's really funny because I want to answer that question. I want to answer the other question that you asked about what young people, young rap listeners can sort of glean from DMX's music. But when I pitched this, or yeah, in the sort of editorial process, my original idea was that X was a bridge between the sort of like spiritual outlaw, tearful gangster figure from the Pac era to, I think, an era that we can speak on now where those sort of elements are found in our, what we consider our most celebrated artists. I think Kendrick is a direct offshoot from that dude. And when I listen to something like Damien where X sort of takes on the role as the devil, like Kendrick does the exact same thing in To Pimp a Butterfly. Like he does the exact same thing. You know, he's talking to Lucifer, right? Like, so I think that I think 21 Savage is also a part of that. I think he's obviously a bit more on the, like, he'll turn up with you every so often. And that's what's up with 21. I fucking love 21 Savage. But I think that's the same thing. His love songs are right next to his songs about death. And anytime that you listen to DMX's music, especially I was listening to Flesh of My Flesh, Blood of My Blood, like crazy over the weekend. And it was damn near line by line. Anytime he was missing death, he was missing love. As if they were just so connected to one another. This is someone who went through so many of his childhood years feeling unloved and feeling betrayed and adopting stray dogs in order to fill that gap. You know what I'm saying? The first time that he got arrested was for going to a dog pound and stealing a dog. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's what that was.
Yeah.
So in terms of what I think young people can learn when they listen to him, there was a gap there. And but with that gap, he really attempted to fill it with loving people externally in real ass ways. And that's why you see all these fan videos, all these fan photos, like all of that stuff. That's why you see that, because he knew that something was missing for him, but he didn't want anything to be missing for anyone else. When you listen to these records, you feel the rage, you feel the emotion, you feel the anger, you hear the prayers at the end of every record. Like, that's him. That's him. And a lot of rappers right now, and I won't name any names, but a lot of rappers right now won't give us that sort of insight into their lives, into their growth, into their evolution, and into the things that, into their very devious, awful impulses. Like, say what you will, that man has some impulses, you know? But that's a life, like you said. That's a life. And for someone to portray their life so sincerely in their music is a rare thing. And I don't know if there was any way to quote unquote save him. And that's nobody's obligation. It isn't one person's obligation to save DMX or to save, you know, whatever. But it's ours as a community, it's his community that kept him alive for as long as it did. A colleague of mine, David Dennis, wrote a piece my last cycle work, The Level. When DMX turned 50, he was like, I'm sorry, it's just like niggas. I live in the hood, so niggas. When he turned 50, he was like, I have no idea how long this happiness that DMX has is going to last, but thank God we have it. You know, thank God we can actually see him happy in this way.
Yeah.
And I love the piece. What I feel like when we saw him in these photos and these videos with fans, we saw him happy. You know, he was there. Like, that's where he found his love. So I would say, like, there's a lot of rap fans who are super isolated, super disillusioned, and are living on the internet and believe that the internet is part of their community. They're not really. And I get why. Because we can make friends on the internet. I feel like our friendship actually grew a lot on the internet.
Yeah.
But it doesn't stand in for being able to really touch somebody and to ask them how they're doing, to see their face as they're explaining it to you, and to relate to that person in a real ass way. And that's what he thought. He wasn't about the celebrity shit. He wasn't about the celebrity relationships. He fucking hated the industry. He wanted to be with the real people, his people. And I think there's a huge lesson in that. We got to find our people, you know. And to a lot of listeners and his audience, DMX lived a lot longer than they thought. You know what I'm saying? As short as it was. And I think that's because of a deep appreciation for the people that he was touching, the people that he showed love to and who loved on him, you know.
I love that. I love that. Yeah. Well, that is Tarhaka love, folks. Where can folks find you on those interwebs, Tarhaka?
Yes. I guess follow me on Twitter at Tarhaka love. That's hard to spell. TIRHAKAHLOVE. My name is indeed my name. Please don't ask no questions. And yeah, I'm they're always down to talk to people. Don't be overly familiar or whatever, but you know, come correct. But I'm always open to talk about, like, you know, we just gotta lay out the ground rules. Listen, don't wall out. I'm on fucking Twitter, bro.
This nigga said, "You can follow me, but I have no obligation to follow that ass back."
Absolutely not. Please do not accept that shit.
Yo, you really got to be telling niggas, because like you said, the internet is a wild world. People really be mistaken recognition for familiarity. No.
Right. It was like, yo, you don't know where we came from, dog. Like, please don't. Please don't. But yeah, you can find me on Twitter. I'm still trying to figure out a home after the big medium shit in terms of work. But you can also see a lot of my work on Medium, tahakalove.medium.com, from the past year or so. There, if you wanna go back into the archives. But yeah, follow me. I'm always down to talk.
Word. Yeah. And if, you know, any of you, if any of you niggas are out there trying to hire an amazing culture writer, you already know what the tea is.
Need that.
Well, fam, this was great. I really appreciate your insight and your thoughtfulness. Truly, truly appreciative. So thank you so much for joining us. And I can't wait to have you again some other time.
Thanks so much for having me, Donna. I really appreciate it.
I want to thank both of my guests. Thank you, Raw. Thank you, Terhaka. I love you both, and I'm so pleased that we could spend some time together. Check out episode 9 coming out next month. We will have John Dennis Gillespie, a PhD student in the Department of Comparative Literature at UC Irvine, to talk to us about his upcoming work, as well as his music, and a few other guests. So, yeah, I'm excited. We will see you all then. In the meantime, of course, you know, you can follow us on Twitter at abolitionish and support and share our Patreon at patreon.com/abolitionish. You can also visit abolitionish.com for merch. I am your host, John Moore. You can follow me on Twitter at incivility, incivilitea. And, yeah, I will see you all on the other side of something better. Free Palestine.